You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 17th of April 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan of Turkey wins his referendum to make himself more presidential, but only just. My guests Robert Fox and Sebastian Borger will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including North Korea and the sudden big hurry to do something about it, France's increasingly odd presidential election as the first round enters its last week, and Britain's weirdly surprised expression as the Brexit bills start to arrive. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Sebastian Borger, the London correspondent for Berliner Zeitung, and Robert Fox, defence editor at the Evening Standard. Welcome both. And we will start in Turkey, where, in what seems to be quite the recurring theme, a populist insurrection is claiming mandate for sweeping changes to the established order on the basis of an electoral margin so thin that it would need to bulk up sufficiently to disguise itself as a wafer. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's bid to upgrade the office he presently holds from that of ribbon-cutting glad-hander to omnipotent overlord was endorsed by 51.4% of voters, give or take some reservations about the propriety of the referendum's conduct. Robert, first of all, on that very point, the OSCE has made a number of criticisms. The opposition parties, or two opposition parties, are challenging the validity of the vote. Is this result going to be seen as legitimate sufficiently for it to be legitimate?
It would be legitimate in the eyes of Mr. Erdogan. And that's all that counts.
Certainly it is now.
And I think that he will go ahead and he will thumb his nose at the world and he will thumb his nose at the OSCE because this is what he has wanted for quite some time. I'm not sure that he did come into office as Prime Minister and envisage it this way, but he's gone way beyond Ataturk. And I think that the commentary over the weekend, I think, was wise, that it is a kind of reinvented Ottomanism for the 21st century. And I think nothing's going to stop him. And he has shown in his manipulation of the media, the roundups after the coup, whatever it really was, with the followers of Fethullah Gulen or not, that he sees himself as being on a roll now. I think, though, that the consequences on such a wafer-thin majority with such a division between town and country, I think it is very, very dangerous, not only for the world, the region, I think because Turkey is so important there, it's very dangerous for Turkey itself.
Sebastian, do you think he will also thumb his nose at the 49.6% of voters who were less than enthused by the prospect of him arrogating still further powers to himself? By which I guess I'm asking, will the narrowness of his win constrain him?
48.6, to be precise.
48. So it is. I did get up very early, but yes, you're right. It is 48.6.
Well, in the end, I suppose it's very similar to Brexit, isn't it? I mean, in Britain, it was 51.9. And you ask people.
There was a certain referendum in the 30s too.
In the 30s in Germany,
it was exactly the same margin, Sebastian. Really, I'm not joking. It's quite striking.
Which referendum are you talking about?
After the Reichstag fire,
There were elections in March 33 and the Nazis got 43%. But of course,
but I think your point, can I just say, I think it's absolutely right about the narrowness of the margin and how difficult it is.
France in 92, the European referendum on the European currency was 50.02 or something. I mean, you know, but in the end, what can you do? You ask people a yes or no question, they answer, and you will follow up on that. I mean, I can't quite see this gentleman who has proven himself to be very, increasingly authoritarian over the last 15 years that he's been in
power. Well, that's the whole point of this referendum, that he is increasingly authoritarian.
That he would now step back and say, oh, well, I only got 51.4%. I can't see it.
Robert, you mentioned that the division between city and country, which I'm glad you did, because it is my own increasingly sort of rigid pet theory of explaining absolutely everything, that is the great struggle in the world between the city and the bush. It is, we've seen that in so many big votes in the last year or so, especially that difference in outlook between rural and urban areas. Erdogan did not win in Istanbul, where he used to be the mayor. He did not win in Ankara, his capital, and he did not win by miles in Izmir, especially. What does it tell us that he didn't win Turkey's... I mean, he didn't win the Kurdish heartlands either, but then he was never going to. But that he didn't win the cities.
This is a very difficult one because it's quite shocking to talk to people of my generation who I would have thought have a very European and internationalist outlook, as I do. And as my family is obviously, you know, being Anglo-Dutch, that the divisions that we're now seeing in these referendums is very, very serious. And we are seeing many different countries. In England, I'm just talking about England, I'm not even talking about Scotland now, we see a generational difference, we see a north-south difference, we see a town and country. Even here, we've seen a town and country division. It is part of not only the mood music, but truly the narrative of the new engine of populism. Elites are against us. Elites are highly qualified. They are privileged. They have better education. They have better business opportunities. And we see this it's like a variation on a grand theme being played out in so many different elections now. Now, let's talk specifically about Turkey, where I have worked quite a bit over the years and I'm fascinated by its history. There is a lot of tail drag on this because the constitutional story of Turkey since Atatürk declared the Turkish Republic in 1923, confirmed in 1924 when the Sultanate fairly completely went, is a very unhappy story. They only had multi-party elections for the first time in 1946. Mm-hmm. They have had, however you want to count it, four serious military coups mm-hmm. since then, including the execution of a prime minister. There is a moderate intellectual religious view which says it is time to tidy the mess up. In fact, there was an extremely interesting signed piece in the New York Times last week about it. Frankly, the place is a mess. It does have problems. It has peculiarly Turkish problems. It's got a major war, internal war going, which makes Northern Ireland, I don't mean to be facetious, look like a picnic, what's going on in eastern Anatolia at the moment.
Provoked by Erdogan.
Well, I agree entirely, Sebastian, because this guy is not a peacemaker.
No.
And this is why it is a large country. And I think that, you know, that the echoes of history are so strong, but he's taking a sort of theme, a mantra from Özal, his predecessor, whom he modelled himself on so many ways. It is the kindred of the great Turkish people. There really is neo-Ottomanism at work here, but how it fits in the real world, I mean, this is the thing that's really worrying. Former in-outer allies like Israel, as they have been and then off, it must worry Russia too as to what is going on now.
Because so one of the things very quickly... So Ottomanism, has that got an imperial tinge
yes,
as well?
Yes.
In that
based
sense,
on kindred.
In that sense, I'm fascinated by what Andrew said about a town and country, or town and bush, as he called it. Are we seeing a problem for the nation state?
Yes, counterintuitively. Dream. Exactly.
Counterintuitively.
This is the final rolling back, I think, the program. It hasn't been done completely yet, but it is the rolling back of the Atatürk, the Kemalist vision of a nation state and autarky.
But also in Britain, I mean, the Britain that we know is under attack, isn't it, from the Brexiteers?
It's very slowly atomizing.
We will come to that later in the show. For the moment, though, we should move on from Turkey and look at North Korea, which is something that US Vice President Mike Pence has been doing from rather closer up, visiting the oxymoronically named demilitarized zone during a visit to South Korea. Vice President Pence affirmed that the US policy of strategic patience, under which the best was done to keep North Korea in its box in the hope that it would sort itself out eventually, eventually was over. The question of the doctrine likely to succeed it has been thus far evasively answered. Sebastian, first of all, why do you think this seems to have become such a thing so quickly? I mean, North Korea has always been a problem. It is a problem. It would be fatuous to deny that, whoever occupies the White House. But why do we seem to be in such a hurry to do something about it in the last 2 weeks?
To be honest, the only explanation I can think of is that the Chinese know something that we don't and have shared that knowledge with the Americans. Because otherwise, I think you're quite right. The guy is clearly less in charge than his father and his grandfather, which makes the whole situation even more volatile than it is. But of course, we've seen terrible famines there before. We've seen political crises before. So it's for an outsider very difficult to understand. I honestly think also the way the Chinese have reacted to the rhetoric coming out of the White House seems to me to suggest that there is something which they don't want to worry our pretty little heads, but that they think we need to tackle it.
This is what I was wondering, and this is what I want to put to you, Robert, that the obvious explanation that struck me, at least, might be the idea that North Korea is closer to a functioning ICBM or a second strike capability than anybody previously thought. Does that seem plausible, that there is now an actual... Because I think, again, you have to sort of detach this from who is in the White House, who is going to have to make this decision. But it seems clear enough that it would be intolerable for North Korea to be possessed of a functioning ICBM, a submarine-borne second strike capability, or all of the above.
I think you have to take your premise out first, and I think it's absolutely right. Don't think Trump too much this time, because very serious people are advising him, and very serious people like McMaster and Mattis are very, very worried. This worry is not feigned. It's not made up. And I agree with Sebastian again that it's the combination I don't quite understand. But I also agree with him. There is something in it. Yes, you can tick off various things like that. In the rhetoric, both sides are talking far too freely of first strike, that we know weaponization is going ahead, and the latest calculation from the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Authority, is that they've got 30 working warheads, and we know from the institutions, the Brookingses and so on, which are to be attended and listened to on this, there is fear that not only will they have an ICBM that can strike the west coast of America, including very much the Los Angeles complex, but it could possibly even get as far as the east coast. So there are big stakes here. But back to a point that Sebastian made, which has emerged so strongly over the past week, is that we don't really know who is actually in charge in Pyongyang, because we see the young leader going to inspect things to show that he is really in charge of the atomic program. I was reading some picture analysis, very good picture analysis of the latest clutch of photos of him showing him with new weapons.
This was the parade at the weekend.
Yeah, but people going to factories. Who is actually doing it? It's thought, according to some, that there are about 6 or 7 competing military clans now looking for interest, and he is just the figurehead, and he can say what on earth he likes. And the change in the mood music, and it's not just music, and I think it's a change in policy, is absolutely palpable from China, because Mr. Xi's regime is a very conservative one with a small c, and he's not dissing Donald Trump. He is saying, we are very worried too about this.
But now, they've been dragging their feet for 10 years, haven't they, the Chinese? Now, they've been keeping it alive, the whole problem. They could have dealt with it 10 years ago.
I think that Trump and Xi are bringing some factors to the party. I don't think all this bluff from Pence and Trump, that they are so worried about the South Korean population and the South Korean polity, which is very fragile at the moment after the latest scandals. But these drills that have been done for real in Japan against a possible attack, this is not crying wolf. This is very important because what worries me is that there are two highly intelligent people in my personal knowledge involved in H.R. McMaster and James Mattis, but they are soldiers. And I wonder if at times they are still thinking in the soldier box.
As in, this looks like a nail and I have a hammer.
Yeah, but they're clever people, though. But remember, and highly experienced, but only highly experienced and to the very highest level and the meanest tactical level in military affairs and military diplomacy. This needs a James Baker or a Henry Kissinger thinking wildly out of the box. Because how do you defuse this one? Because being defused, to the regime in Pyongyang means then the house, you have them puff and the house really does
and,
come down.
And Rex Tillerson is no James Baker.
No.
Sebastian, what have you made of, I guess, media coverage here where we live of this? Because with all due recognition, as we have been duly recognising that there is an issue here and that this is serious, what has struck me in the last couple of weeks is if you read Chosun Ilbo and other South Korean newspapers, their attitude is very much... They barely seem interested. They are the people who live next door to this, and they're reporting it, saying, "Oh yeah, yakety yak yak, blah blah blah." But it's not the front page. Whereas you know we have seen, I guess, the more excitable tabloid press in Britain here, especially, you know, all but suggesting that you start painting your windows white.
This is a very slight exaggeration, but yes, I suppose, in a way, I mean, that speaks volumes for the responsibility of the South Korean media, don't you think? Because, I mean, if they had the similar headlines, which they could well have, then, you know, we might well see panic in Seoul, which, after all, is, what, 40 kilometers from the border? I mean,
and there's a population between there and Pyongyang of over 30 million.
You don't need any atomic weapons. You just use your artillery to kill peoples in their tens of thousands. It is very worrying. Whatever, let's by all means diss the British tabloids, but not pleasant.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Miller, along with Sebastian Borger and Robert Fox. Coming up next, France's presidential election. Sorry, I got those two words the wrong way around. I'll try that again. France's presidential election, 6 days out.
What is culture with Robert Bound?
This is the show of shows.
There was something really magical about it.
Everybody's boozing, having grand adulterous love affairs. There's fabulous fist fights. And everybody is smoking opium.
How did that get in there? Well, we're not enjoying the after party. We're on an intrepid investigation each week to answer questions like how do you adapt a novel and how do you start an art collection? Culture with Robert Bound is your one-stop shop for the answers to the cultural questions that leave you scratching your head every day. Grab a drink, pull up a chair, and tune in every Monday at 1900 London time.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Sebastian Borger and Robert Fox. Now, it has been quite a year or so for the previously improbable and hitherto unlikely, so we must at least contemplate the possibility that this time next week we are anticipating a second round runoff in France's presidential election between two Eurosceptic populists, one of the far right and one of the far left. If polls are accurate, a showdown between Marine Le Pen and Jean-Luc Mélenchon is roughly as likely an outcome as any other. Robert, it's getting stranger and stranger. How solid does the Mélenchon surge look to you?
Well, it's come up. It's the dark horse on the inside rail because he's only a point or so behind the favourite, Mr. Macron. It's really as if Bernie Sanders rose up Lazarus-like just as America was going to the polls on November the 6th, I believe it was, and said, actually, I'm running too, and I think you're going to vote for me. And there is a similarity in his, again, awful word, populism, but it is applied appositely in his case because he does speak with... quite some approval of Hugo Chavez, of the Castro brothers, and he's got a radical past, although he denies that he was really a communist, but he emerged in the imbroglio of French socialist politics, and they've probably continued ever since the late 70s. But it's a new voice, and the fact that he's winning so much approval shows how sceptical the French electorate is about Marine Le Pen, about Monsieur Macron, who I think is fragile, and I think he could have the rug pulled from under his feet by Mr. Mélenchon. And Fillon just looks like being a spoiler at the moment. And it's going to be very interesting to see in the second round where the Fillon votes go.
Well, on that subject, Sebastian, the idea that Fillon is a spoiler, the fact is that he is still hanging in. He's not actually out of this, which is bizarre, given all the scandals that have beset his campaign. And thinking of the scandals that beset his campaign, could there be a shy Fillon factor in the polls? Could there actually be, between that and a sort of, I guess, a retreat to normality, a surprise result for him?
And would we prefer that? I mean, I hardly dare say it, but would we prefer Mr. Fillon in the second round to Mr. Mélenchon? First of all, I find fascinating that we have two big blocks on the left, center-left and the center-right, the Socialist Party and the Republicans. And both of them basically, we think, out of the running. We don't even talk about the socialist candidate anymore. Can anyone remember his name? I can't. Yeah. Emor, or something
off the
like
top
that.
Of my head, no.
Because Wales didn't run, yeah.
you know, and so we're confronted. I mean, this is the sixth largest industrial nation in the world. Mm. And we are seriously talking about two people who are absolutely beyond the pale of anything that the financial markets or indeed the European allies will stand for.
I mean, we're also talking about
France can go its own way if it wants to. I cannot see Angela Merkel starting to cooperate with either Marine Le Pen or this communist bloc. Seriously, I mean, the French must really, in the next few days, take a hard look at themselves and realize that they have to be serious players on the world stage.
We're also talking about an election, Robert, in which three of the four front runners have either no or next to no representation in the national parliament. I mean, is if one of those three becomes the next president, are they really actually going to mean anything?
Well, then the proof will be in the general election.
Indeed.
For the Assembly, and it could be crazy. I was just going to add to what Sebastian has said, because, of course, Mélenchon and Le Pen are against the euro and against, this could be, I'm not saying a body blow, but it could be a hammer blow for the
EU
and it's the EM.
If France seriously considers leaving the euro, we might as well forget about
it. Yeah. But what is so interesting, as we're contemplating this landscape, as we frequently have over the past 6 months, you have Trump, completely untried. You have the front runners, should we put it that, including all the runners, actually, particularly in the case of also of Macron, relatively untried in parliamentary experience and so on. And then in the middle of all this, we have had the Dutch, who behaved in a very, very interesting way. They corralled, they more or less incubated, isolated the guy who was always going to be there. That was the attitude of the Dutch electorate, as far as we can make out, to Wilders. Oh, you'll always get the 30% or whatever. You get, on the one hand, a sudden surge from the incumbent, Mark Rutte, because he was admired for his skill, particularly in handling Erdogan in a really nasty little crisis where Erdogan tried to upset him just as they were coming up to the polls. And he really did it very well. And the other thing...
And again, he adopted of the Wilders rhetoric as well.
Yeah, and can I also say that it's also part of this whole discussion that we're having here. The young went for the environmentalists, a formidable environmental alliance between the left, Green,
and the Animal Rights Party, who've expanded their platform, who virtually were the second force in the election there. So we're seeing some very, very interesting things going. The old managed to hang on by being intelligent in the Netherlands, but there were new forces even there coming up that we didn't really calculate.
Well, finally, and on a semi-related note, we should look at post-Brexit Britain, which in the 10 months since voting to leave the EU has rather resembled the protagonist in the joke about the man who hurls himself from a high building and spends the descent thinking this is going fine so far. However, since the triggering of Article 50 last month, the first intimations of the looming footpath have come into focus. Most recently, the revelation that the European Medicines Agency and European Banking Authority are likely to decamp London for elsewhere. There will not be a shortage of welcoming options. Sebastian, speaking on behalf of the entire remaining European Union, does the United Kingdom yet have a complete sense of the kicking it is going to get on the way out?
I'm reluctant to talk about a kicking, but I am also flabbergasted by this story in today's Financial Times, where apparently the British government has seriously argued that these two agencies could stay in London.
And then it's almost like nobody gave any thought whatsoever to the consequences, isn't it?
You think either they're prepared to put a large amount of money Brussels way and say this is something which we are very keen on, particularly, of course, the Medicines Agency. And therefore, we are desperate to keep that in London. Or they have completely lost their marbles over the Easter weekend. Or, which is equally worrying, they are actually trying to use these two agencies as bargaining chips. In which case, I can only imagine what the negotiation's going to be like. This is an overall strategic problem I have with the British government's pronouncements so far. I cannot for the life of me see the advantage of making completely wacky proposals and thinking that the European partners will sort of meet you halfway. I simply don't think they will. You know, you cannot, if you leave the club, which is your which is Britain's right to do, but you can't seriously keep agencies like that in the country. It doesn't work.
And Robert, beyond this, are we going to see, because this also strikes me as an under-considered possibility, the idea that not just European agencies, but banks, businesses, other multinational entities, even the ones that don't want to leave, are going to threaten to, aren't they, in search of a better deal than the one they already have?
Well, the story is also of Lloyds Bank. It had to get its branch opened in Berlin. It has to get a European operation going. This is where I find the reality check is extremely difficult. I do, in my normal daily tasks, talk to quite a lot of civil servants and experts, and they're in despair. Because,
as well they should be.
Because whoever it was, I think it may have been a co-national of yours, Sebastian, who said in the European Parliament, quite rightly, this is a spat within a party which has got completely out of control. To the extent that...
He means the UK Conservative Party.
Yeah. And I've talked to luminaries of that party, and they seem not to have the first clue. And I have talked to contemporaries who have voted Brexit. They seem to have absolutely no idea what is involved in untangling the European regulation, which we've worked to 98% perfectly happily and more over the past 40 years. And it's pulling that apart. I think it's going to be a disaster for the UK. For people out in the country, like my brother who voted Brexit, they simply do not understand two things where there was a false prospectus. One, the country is going to be a lot poorer. Two, you cannot stop migration by saying we're going it alone and we're pulling up the drawbridge. It ain't as simple as that.
But particularly the first thing, I have to say, if I was to advise Theresa May, that would have been the first thing I would have advised her to do. Tell people consistently, this is going to be difficult and expensive. We have taken a decision. We want that. And I will go through with it. But you have to face the fact that it's going to be difficult and expensive. And she doesn't do it. I don't understand why.
Because she wants to win a general election.
When did we last hear a politician telling its electorate it was going to have to
She's
face
any
fact? She's
got a 21% lead in the polls. She's got a totally useless opposition. She, if anybody, could do it.
I knew you were going to get excited, Sebastian. But the fact is that when the gild comes off the gingerbread, as we say, yeah. and people get disillusioned with her, it could be she could be in Mr. Brown territory, as in Gordon Brown.
Sebastian Borger and Robert Fox, thank you both very much for joining us. That's all we have time for on today's Midori House. It was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Anthea Longo. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. More music next, more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200, and Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.